Today on Wings, an interview with Ai Zhen Pu, the head of the National Domestic Workers Alliance in the US. She spent years pushing to get fair treatment for the huge numbers of women who work in other people's homes.
Caregiving is really life's greatest gift, whether you're providing it or receiving it. It is one of the most important elements of humanity and should be valued as such.
But all too often, it's not.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
I'm Ashley Milne-Tight. I'm a reporter based in New York, and recently I attended a conference at Barnard College called Justice in the Home, Domestic Work, Past, Present, and Future. Domestic work has changed over the years. In the US today, few people have servants, but plenty of people employ nannies and home health aides. These workers let millions of better-off Americans go to their own jobs each day. The US population is aging, and the position of home health worker is the fastest-growing job in the country. But wages are low, and the mostly women who do this job usually don't have health insurance. Few regulations govern their pay or hours. Then there are the nannies who look after children while their parents are at the office. Traditionally, they've had virtually no job protections either. Ai Zhen Pu aims to change that. In fact, she started years ago, right after she left college. She's now the head of an organization that's helping to improve the lives of low-wage women across the country. She was in New York to give the keynote address at the Justice in the Home conference.
My name is Ai Zhen Pu, and I'm the director of the National Domestic Workers Alliance. And I advocate for respect and recognition for the millions of women who go to work every day in other people's homes.
So first of all, I should start by saying congratulations for winning a MacArthur Genius Grant.
Thank you very much. I'm incredibly excited and honored by it and know that we'll be able to really elevate the stories and the experiences of this workforce through having that platform.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, what are you going to do? How are you going to spend that money?
We are going to be establishing a new fellowship for domestic workers. So we'll take the MacArthur Fellowship and create a fellowship that will enable domestic workers themselves to gain experience and expertise in shaping public policy that is affecting the women in this workforce and really the future of the economy.
So you did not grow up with domestic workers or having any exposure to domestic workers. So how did you come to be so passionate? How did this come to be your mission?
So I come from a really long line of strong women who are both caregivers and work. And my grandmother's work was caregiving. She was a nurse for many, many years. And she also helped to raise me when I was very young, and really shaped my values. And one of the things that she always used to say is that caregiving is really life's greatest gift, whether you're providing it or receiving it. It is one of the most important elements of humanity and should be valued as such. And so I think I grew up with that care as a value. And then growing up, actually seeing that there was a disconnect between that value and experience and the rest of the world really not valuing that work and even accounting for it, assuming that it'll get done, and really making it invisible. The other thing that happened was I got involved at as a volunteer at a domestic violence shelter and found that all of the women who were working in low-wage jobs like domestic work had a very difficult time breaking out of cycles of violence at home because of the economic insecurity that came from working in a low-wage job. And so I think part of it for me is about figuring out how we in the 21st century make a breakthrough in terms of economic opportunity and security for women who are at the bottom of our economy. And as it turns out, 2/3 of all minimum wage workers are women, and that is definitely not the direction that we should be going in.
Tell me about the genesis of the National Domestic Workers Alliance.
Absolutely. Well, domestic workers have been organizing in the United States for many generations and iterations. And this generation of organizing that I've been a part of is about 20 years old. And it started in big cities like New York and Los Angeles and San Francisco and Washington, D.C. As more women started entering the workforce, there became an increased need for paid caregivers in the home. And more women started doing this work, but were facing extreme levels of abuse and exploitation and vulnerability. And a natural outgrowth of that was women coming together to support each other and to seek assistance and gathering in church basements and immigrant community centers. And those were the that was in the mid-90s that started happening in all of these cities. And I was a part of some of those early efforts here in New York City, really looking for ways to expand economic opportunity for women and improve jobs that women were holding in the economy here in New York. And it was always the domestic workers who were so anxious to organize and come together as a group because of the incredible isolation that you face working behind closed doors in somebody else's home. And I think that that has been the sort of natural impetus for this movement over many generations in this country, but it's really driven us to be able to continue to grow and to be really worker-led. Mm.
But when did you start, or how did National Domestic Workers Alliance start? Mm. Because I know it didn't start off in quite the same form that it is now.
Right. No, so it kind of, in the same way that individual domestic workers kind of broke out of their isolation to come to meetings and join these groups that eventually grew locally, we as local organizations around the country broke out of our isolation and came together in 2007 in Atlanta, Georgia for the first national meeting of domestic workers. It was about 50 of us, organizers and workers who from six different cities, and we talked about, we shared experiences and stories and challenges and also victories, and just felt the power of what it could be like to have a real national voice for this workforce, and decided right then and there to form the alliance. And so at that point, we represented six cities and 12 organizations that had come together. And today we're in 26 cities with 45 affiliate organizations around the country who are all working together to build this movement.
Right, because I was going to ask you what groups were under your umbrella. It sounds like even more than I thought.
Oh yeah, we have groups everywhere from Tuscaloosa to Alabama to Seattle, Washington, and new groups forming all the time in places like Phoenix, Arizona, or El Paso, Texas, or even in Ohio, Cincinnati. I mean, this work, you know, the caregiving for the aging is the fastest growing occupation in the country because people are living longer than ever. And the baby boom generation is starting to reach retirement age. So there's this huge need on the part of families for care in their homes. And so there's just this growth of the workforce, and parallel to that, a real growth of our movement.
Can you give me a sense of the history of the National Domestic Workers Alliance and, you know, some of your organizing methods and what's happened along the road during these last 7 years?
Absolutely. So when we formed in 2007, the New York affiliate groups were in the middle of a campaign for what's called the Domestic Workers Bill of Rights. And New York State was the first state to fight for and win labor protections at the state level for domestic workers, protections that would not only remedy generations of exclusion from basic labor laws, but also create increased protections for the workforce that account for the special challenges that you face when you're working in such isolated conditions. and without much ability to really negotiate for things like paid sick days, for example. And so organizers and workers in New York started working on this in 2003, and in 2010, the New York State became the first state to pass a domestic workers' bill of rights. And at that point, we were already organizing around the country, and it just inspired domestic workers around the country to really assert the rights that they have, but also to seek new rights and protections under the law. And so now, you know, 4 years later, there are four states that have enacted domestic worker bills of rights, and we're working in several others starting in 2015, and we're trying to take that work to the next level. We want to first make sure that everyone knows their new rights in these states, but there's so much more to be done in terms of things like paid holidays and sick days and basic job security questions and control over hours and just a sense of respect and recognition that this is real work and families and our economy need to account for it, and that that's in everyone's interest to do.
That Domestic Workers' Bill of Rights was obviously a huge success for you and widely covered. What about some of the obstacles? What do you consider some of the most stubborn obstacles you've had to face and you're still facing, maybe?
Well, we are living in a very polarized and challenging political environment. And so, you know, first, most people told us that it would be impossible to organize domestic workers, and that, you know, this isolated workforce that was sort of hidden behind closed doors could never sustain real growth and building of organizations and movement. And so that was the first real challenge to us. Could we do the impossible, which was to actually organize and have our voices be heard?
And
we have. and we are continuing to build now in 26 cities. It's really incredible. Other challenges are, you know, it's interesting. Our work is like the most visible, invisible workforce. So everybody knows that there are so many domestic workers who really are sort of at the backbone of the economy. That, you know, in New York, you could just walk down any street in Manhattan and see a nanny pushing a stroller and know, right? And yet there's so little visibility and so little stability. So, you know, I think in general, for us to raise awareness in the general public and among families that homes are also workplaces for many women, and that for employers who may not think of themselves as employers, right, that they have responsibilities. So there's just a whole bunch of education and awareness raising that has to happen that's been challenging in such a diffuse environment where it's everybody and nobody, you know, at the same time. And so that's another challenge. And in this kind of polarized political environment, you will have some people who are just incredible champions of women and of immigrants and of low-wage workers. And then you have people who think that anything having to do with those issues is, you know, directly opposed to their agenda. And so we have to figure out when it is an issue that touches everybody, finding new ways of finding so-called unlikely allies and ways of talking about what's at stake here that really reaches beyond the traditional political debates that have so paralyzed us in terms of progress. So that has also been a challenge, and finding and the truth is like that's where we've made some of our biggest breakthroughs, and realizing that in some ways when it's about human dignity and basic fairness, that there really is no such thing as an unlikely ally, and that you really do have to continue to reach out and tell the stories, the human story behind the issues that you're working on. And that's what this movement has really been all about, is about that story, that invisible, untold story of domestic work and its significance in our economy and in our families, and the role that everyone has to play in really bringing value to that work.
You're listening to Wings. I'm Ashley Milne-Tight, and I'm talking to Aijen Poo, head of the National Domestic Workers Alliance. She campaigns for the dignity and respect of domestic workers.
You may have partly covered this in what you've been talking about with how you reach out to domestic workers, but I was going to sort of ask, how do you interact with them? I mean, are there certain nannies and home care workers who actually come to your offices on a regular basis? How does it work?
Sure. We have leaders who are very active and are essentially like organizers out there every day talking to other workers. And we have regular meetings. All of our affiliates have regular meetings where domestic workers know that at a certain time every month, the same place, you know, that there will be a meeting that they can come to that's open to hear from other workers, to learn more about their rights, to get questions they have answered, and to also learn more about our programs and campaigns. And one of the things that really does attract a lot of interest is our training programs. We offer nanny training programs and elder care training programs that help people gain skills and knowledge that's useful to them in their work, and actually, you know, graduate with a certificate that then demonstrates that they have these new skills. And and oftentimes it's really just refining the skills that people have already developed through doing this work over many years. But there's such important skills in terms of healthcare and child development and long-term well-being of families. And so there's a lot of curriculum out there that the workforce finds really beneficial. And so that's a way that a lot of people come into the work. And a lot of people want to do something about the wages and the working conditions. And so our policy campaigns are things that people are really interested in getting involved with and definitely learning more about. So I think because we're such an active movement and there's always things going on, whether it's a, you know, cultural celebration or a training or a Know Your Rights clinic or something like that, that there's a lot of ways for people to engage, and you never quite know what's going to speak to somebody because there's so many different needs and experiences of women in this workforce, but we try to create lots of options.
The issue of domestic workers, how do you think it meshes or doesn't with other aspects of sort of feminist organizing and theory?
Well, we definitely see our work as about building kind of a new generation of a women's movement, really strengthening, creating new leaders, a new face on the women's movement, new perspectives, new priorities, new narrative, and new policy goals. I mean, having domestic workers' rights be a core pillar in a women's agenda for the future, I think, is going to be really key to having the women's movement feel more encompassing and more reflective of who women are today. So we absolutely see ourselves as part of a long history of women's organizing and see our role as helping to lead the way into the future.
And this came up a little bit at today's conference, U.S. immigration policy and how that affects domestic workers in this country. How do you think about that topic, and what changes would you like to see?
Well, the majority of our members are immigrant, and many of them are undocumented, and it's a huge barrier to women feeling comfortable exercising their rights. And even though the rights are limited, there certainly are rights that workers have on the job, even if you're undocumented. But it's such an experience of vulnerability that it's so difficult to really exercise your rights and assert the rights that you have. And I think that it becomes a tool for unscrupulous employers to really take advantage. Not that all employers are going to do that, but there will be, it creates an environment where that's possible. And that's a big part of why it's been difficult to elevate conditions for domestic workers, because so many of the women doing this work are undocumented and vulnerable to deportation. So being undocumented means that you essentially live in fear of deportation or detention. And oftentimes that means living in fear of being separated from your family who's here. And every day we hear stories of family separation, devastating stories of family separation, women who've been here for over a decade and whose children's entire experience is here in this country and who don't have connections to their home countries, actually living in fear of being separated. And so there's so much at stake in terms of immigration reform, and we're very optimistic that the president is going to take action to address the situation of undocumented workers and offer relief and work authorization to undocumented immigrants. It's an election campaign promise of his that we expect he will come through on, and it will be really game-changing in terms of the ability of women who do this work to live without fear and to work in an environment where they can bring the best of who they are to the job every day, and also for the families to know that the women that they count on to take care of their families every day are no longer vulnerable and could no longer be disappeared at any given moment. So there's a lot at stake for American citizen families who count on an immigrant workforce.
I presume that those who are working as domestic workers and are undocumented, that they can expect to be paid less than someone who is a citizen. Do you find that in your work?
I do find that because it's harder for women to negotiate if they are vulnerable, then yes, absolutely, you know, employers will take advantage of that and pay less. And it affects everybody, because once one set of workers is unable to really assert their rights, then it kind of creates a gravitational pull where wages for the entire sector kind of get pulled downward because the floor kind of has fallen out from under. And so absolutely undocumented workers are earning less, and that has an impact on everybody.
Some of the stories you hear of experiences that these women have been through are almost unbelievable. They're so shocking. It's hard to believe that in the 2000s that this kind of treatment can be being meted out to somebody who lives in the home of people who are quite wealthy here in New York City, for example. Do you have any sense of how frequently women are really abused in the homes that they live in versus have good situations versus somewhere in the middle? Are these extreme stories that you sometimes hear of people not even having a bed of their own, having to sleep beneath children's beds, having been verbally abused, are they very common?
You know, it's interesting. I mean, this is why we call the domestic kind of workforce industry the Wild West, is because you'd never quite know what you're going to get. And there are those cases of extreme, extreme, horrific abuse and trafficking and modern-day slavery and sexual assault and harassment. And then there's also stories of wonderful relationships between families and the workers who work with them that span for generations. And there's everything in between. And the thing that is so egregious is that everyone is equally vulnerable. It's just not everybody is abused and taken advantage of, but everyone could be, because of the lack of standards, the lack of recognition that this is real work, and the exclusion from protections that has been kind of a part of our policy for so long. So everyone is vulnerable to extreme abuse. Not everyone experiences it, but everyone is vulnerable to it because of the lack of standards and because of a culture in this sector where kind of anything goes. It's sort of at the whim of individual employers, which just means that, again, you never quite know what you're going to get. And to me, I find that the fact that everyone is vulnerable in that way to be what's egregious, that there's actually a structural problem there that makes everyone more precarious. And absolutely, you know, I would say that I have worked on so many of these cases of extreme abuse, and it is always shocking to me that this is still happening, you know, that there are still these cases of modern day slavery. And I think it should be equally as shocking to all of us that this work is still not really recognized such that there are real standards that we can enforce here.
One final question, being a bit nosy here, because I know, you know, your domestic situation has changed and you're living with your boyfriend in Chicago. I just wonder how you feel, like, if you were to have a family, how do you feel about the possibility of having a nanny, for instance?
Well, you know, I think as somebody who spends days and nights advocating for workers, if I were to ever become an employer, that I would be a very good one. And I have no judgments on people who hire, because I think that these jobs are real jobs and that they are critical jobs in our economy that need to be good jobs for the 21st century, and we should recognize them as such. I think, however, that the options that families have are so limited, and that it's not really working for anyone, that families really struggle to afford quality childcare, and there's something really wrong with that picture. I mean, families are a given. It's not, you know, we want families, and we want families to be healthy and thriving, and so the fact that we don't have adequate family care supports for families such that they can get their child care and elder care needs met while ensuring that the jobs that get created in the process are good jobs, that seems like an obvious building block of a healthy economy and society that is really missing. So for me, I think that I will need to solve this problem as an individual, hopefully someday. But ultimately, what I'm trying to do and what my movement's trying to do is come up with a situation where we can really have more choices for families out there, where it doesn't feel like it's precarious in the way that it is now.
Aijen Poo, head of the National Domestic Workers Alliance. She was in New York to give the keynote address at the Justice in the Home conference.
That interview was recorded by Ashley Milne-Tight on October 17, 2014, 1 month after Aijen Poo was awarded a MacArthur Genius Grant. The foundation cited her tireless grassroots organizing and strategizing, leading domestic workers and their employers to win the first state domestic workers' bill of rights in the U.S., and federal minimum wage and overtime protection for caregivers for the elderly and disabled.
You can find out more about Aijen Poo and her work at the National Domestic Workers Alliance at their website. That's at www.domesticworkers.org. I'm Ashley Milne-Tight. I host a show about women in the workplace called The Broad Experience. You can find that at www.thebroadexperience.com.
Please support the local community radio stations that carry Wings and tell them you enjoy the shows. Stations that gave to us in the last year include WERU in Maine, WORT in Wisconsin, KKFI in Missouri, KCSB and KMUD in California, and KGNU and KRZA in Colorado. Individual supporters include Dr. Carolyn Byerly, Sally Powell Ashby, Janice Cohen, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, whose works on the gift economy can be found online. Contact us by email, wings@wings.org, and visit our daily news feed at facebook.com/wingsradio. I'm the Wings series producer, Frida Worden. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle Is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.